There's no place to escape to.
This is the last podcast.
On the left.
Right from your glade.
That's when the cannibalism started.
What was that?
Okay, guys. Listen, we'll be talking a lot of smack, but I think what's important before we start today's episode, we each name one thing that we love and cherish about white culture. Choose something. Choose something. What do you love? What do you celebrate? What celebrates white people?
I celebrate them.
Kolaches.
The fidget spinners. I don't know. What the hell? What? I have no idea.
Comic-Cons.
Okay.
That's finally some positivity besides just never being arrested for a crime and always being president.
All right. This is the last podcast on the left. I am Ben Kissel. That's Marcus Parks. And I don't think I introduced us last time, as a matter of fact.
I bet you didn't. I don't think you did.
I don't know.
We're sitting here. We're in my Los Angeles apartment.
Yeah.
It's hot. My feet are up. I can smell my own balls
because
I'm wearing like gym shorts because it's too hot in here.
I'm 3 inches away from you. It's a really great experience. All right. Well, let's get on here. We got Oklahoma City Part 4. A lot more to get to in the Timothy McVeigh saga.
So in September of 1994, President Bill Clinton approved the 10-year assault rifle ban, and with that, the gathering of the explosives and components needed for the April 19th bombing truly began.
Now, in conspiratorial thought, let's take a little break from rationality for a second. I mean, honestly, guys, we're always so rational and logical.
That's exactly how I describe you.
Now, would that maybe be the conspiratorial arm of being like, basically they make a gun ban, and that's what allows them to send in covert agents into the different white nationalist groups in order to spur revolutionary attitude? Basically, they create the legislature and then create the backbone of sending in sheep.
No,
dip.
Do you have any idea what it takes to pass a fucking bill?
No. I never watched Cool House Rock.
Yeah, there's a cartoon that explains it. This whole thing is ridiculous, though. It got totally blown out of proportion. Brady bill was kind of wrapped up into this. They weren't going after weapons that were already sold as assault rifles. They weren't going into people's homes and taking them. They were just putting a halt on the sale of assault rifles.
Just like, you know what? We got enough assault rifles.
So many of them.
You guys can sell assault rifles to each other. That's totally cool. You can do that whenever and wherever you want. We're just not going to make any more of them.
If I was president, I would also put a 10-year ban on pornography. We're good. We have enough.
What is wrong with you?
We have so much.
What are you talking about?
This town, Los Angeles, will grind to a halt.
I'm sorry, never mind.
This is Northern California.
It's off the table.
I saw a gangbang video this morning that I'd never seen before, and it made me happy.
Congrats.
Well, that was an immediate democracy. Thank you for the town hall. I have now changed my position.
Now, there is a very interesting connection to Elohim City concerning September of 1994, the same month that the assault rifle ban was signed. The only two recorded instances of McVeigh being near Elohim City was a ticket in the fall of 1993, not too long after McVeigh met Strassmeyer, and a night McVeigh spent in a motel just over the Arkansas state line near Elohim City on September 12th, 1994, the day before the assault rifle ban was signed into law.
Can you imagine being the poor woman or a man that works at that hotel that has to clean up the room after Timothy McVeigh?
Every single time, just having to deal with all the different hair clippings from keeping his brush cut tight.
I feel like they actually go and like untuck the sheets a little bit. They're like, this man must be a sociopath. These sheets are so tucked.
I think he's the kind of guy that eats the soap thinking it's food.
So in October of 1994, McVeigh took over a storage locker in Harrington, Kansas, which Terry Nichols had planned to use to store furniture. And McVeigh started loading it up with all the material needed for the bomb.
Now, Tim, I definitely, you know, I give you an inch. And you took a mile, and when it comes down to it, where am I going to put these duvets? I have piles and piles of duvets. I have a levee chair. I forgot what that's called, the liaison, where you lay down it so you look impressively bored. I have one of those chairs, a chaise lounge.
I like that. You know what? What if we fill it with ammonium nitrate instead?
Whatever you want, Tim. I guess you're my boss now.
I would love to see that this storage locker opened on Storage Wars. Just be like, what do we got there? Oh, all the makings of a bomb.
Close up the storage. Can we close up the shed?
So the nuts and bolts materials McVeigh and Terry acquired from a quarry robbery. The fuel came from racing tracks and hobby stores who both sold nitromethane for different reasons.
Cool.
Of course, not to make homemade bombs?
Interesting.
No, racing tracks sold it for nitro, and hobby stores sold it for model airplanes.
Making model airplanes, they say.
There is a hidden demographic of sniffers and huffers, and they're all in the model airplane business.
So the ammonium nitrate was purchased in 8 different locations. operations, with McVeigh and Nichols stopping off at every feed store they could find to eventually amass 4,000 pounds of the stuff. Hmm. Now, after the two had spent a couple months gathering up all this material, Nichols started getting a little suspicious about the whole stockpiling explosives things, as he said he thought at this point that the whole thing was just kind of a lark.
Because honestly, it started with his obsession with Pop Rocks, and I thought at that point, I was like, I don't
put
even
it
like
in
them
soda.
Because it hurts my gums, I don't like it, but he loved it, and it started with Pop Rocks, and then immediately he killed a dog with a hand grenade.
What do you think? Terry Nichols just tried to wash his hands of all this, right? He had to know something was going on.
Of course.
Yeah, he knew something was going on, but Nichols was two things. He was a coward, of course.
Yes.
And he was also very good at denial.
Mm. Well, they're also very private.
Yes.
So all of these guys are very much so that weird sovereign citizen thing of like, you know, like don't remember anything about me.
Right.
Almost.
Mm. Now, when Nichols confronted McVeigh, Tim came clean about the plan, and when Nichols said he wouldn't have any part of it, Nichols said that McVeigh pulled his jacket back and showed him the .45 in his shoulder holster. Nichols said McVeigh told him that if he didn't go through with it, McVeigh would kill his son, his brother, and his mother. This, Nichols said, was his main motivation for helping Tim all the way to the end.
I don't know about that. Is that a threat or a promise, Tim? Why don't you kill somebody that doesn't make me sad all the time?
That's what I'm thinking. Just flip it and be like, here are their home addresses. Perfect. Thank you.
And in order to pay for the whole bombing operation, McVeigh said Nichols was going to have to procure the money by robbing McVeigh's old friend from the gun circuit, Roger Moore, whom McVeigh referred to as Bob from Arkansas. Hmm. Because Bob Miller was the name that Roger Moore would use at gun shows. Because a lot of times these gun show guys, they didn't use their real names there. They didn't trust each other.
It's like how Robert De Niro, if you know him in a movie and you have to like do some kind of talk about him like on the side for like BTS or kind of interview, you call him Bobby.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So they're going to rob their friend.
They're going to rob their friend. Now, the motivations here are actually a little unclear. McVeigh said that he learned Roger's security system while he was there visiting and that Roger deserved it because he was a plastic patriot who would turn his stockpile over to the FBI without a fight. Now, it is very possible that Roger knew the whole thing was coming and that the robbery was set up in order to conceal where the funding was coming from for the bombing, a kind of like backwoods money laundering type operation.
Kind of like him putting a basically getting a hotel room next to Elohim City so he can go stay there without there being any sort of trail leading him over there. Because he can say, oh, look, here, I was actually staying at a hotel.
Mm-hmm. I do love it when you know the person robbing you. We're just like, Terry, what are you doing? Put the gun down. But now, was this a part of Operation Clean Sweep? He just gave up his guns?
No, he didn't give up his guns. McVeigh said that if Roger Moore had his property raided, then Roger Moore would just give up his guns without a fight. But he said he was a plastic.
They speculated that.
Yeah, they speculated.
Oh, I see.
He's a poser.
He was a poser because McVeigh thought that if you had a bunch of guns and the government stormed your property, then you needed to fight to the death
and commit
for
suicide.
Those guns.
Yeah, that's the idea. That's a real patriot does.
Yeah.
They stupidly die.
Well, the reason why some people think that Roger Moore was forewarned about it and was even in on this robbery was because for months afterwards, McVeigh and Moore exchanged a series of bizarre cryptic letters, even though it was obvious that McVeigh was behind the whole thing. And Moore made sure to say that Timothy McVeigh was behind the robbery loudly and often.
My best friend, Timothy McVeigh, came all the way to Arkansas just to steal my gold.
Because you know he kept his money in gold.
Oh, of course.
No, he did, but he stole a bunch of gold, a bunch of silver, and a lot of precious jewels. Like
what is this, the Goonies?
We were talking about this the other day. At the end of the Goonies, these kids think that like just emeralds and rubies are good. Like, could it not be just, it's difficult to fence these
things. So that Snickers bar will be $1.25. I only have pirate's money.
One sapphire. It's a marble.
No, in one of those cryptic letters, Moore wrote to McVeigh 9 days before the bombing. Moore wrote,
"Plan is to bring the country down and have a few more things happen. The important thing is to make it as effective as possible."
And Moore signed the letter Bob and wrote, "Burn," in uppercase letters next to his signature. And when the FBI questioned Moore, he said that he was just trying to lure McVeigh to his ranch so McVeigh could be arrested for the robbery.
Because that's how it always works.
A bunch of heroes.
Burn. Wow. Bring your raccoon net.
It's a W that yours starts with.
What?
Yeah, it's a W.
It's a Y.
A Y.
Jesus Christ.
What is wrong with you?
Why? It starts with a W, however.
Are you from Elohim City? Are you running
for Brooklyn?
No, you know
Brooklyn
what?
Bureau President. You cannot spell the word your.
It has been a long week stuck in traffic, and the LA sun does take your brain cells out.
It absolutely does.
But honestly, Tim, when you do come into town, bring your raccoon net, because it is my whole fucking compound is infested, and I'm not doing cute racist raccoon. I mean real dog-shaped guy raccoon.
It's like buffalo in here.
And as for the effective as possible line, Morse said he just couldn't remember what he meant by that. Yeah. He's like, yeah. So the FBI came and asked, so what did you mean by this line? It must be as effective as possible. He's like, you know what? I just don't remember.
Huh.
And honestly, I was talking about minoxidil.
Isn't that wild?
And as shitty of an answer as that was, the FBI totally believed him and set him free without any follow-up. Now, it could be that Moore, who had much more experience with explosives than either McVeigh or Nichols, had more to do with the plot than anyone is letting on. Except Terry Nichols. Nichols told investigators fairly recently that a pack of the explosive component kinesticks could be found on his property with Bob Moore's fingerprints on them. The FBI did find the kinesticks, but they didn't test them for fingerprints for another 3 years. And after those 3 years, the prints were deemed unreadable. Moore also claimed to be a protected government witness at one point, but on the other hand, a lot of these guys claim to be protected government witnesses.
Because it's a fun idea.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah, Strassmeyer said that same thing.
But we do. That is how the FBI gets these people. They flip them and force them to rat on other people.
Maybe
so it's possible.
Honestly, they probably were fishing. Well, they're probably asking him to see what he knew, see if he'd be willing to flip, and he'd be like, no. But secretly,
Well, it's actually oddly plausible to think that these different government agencies who weren't talking to each other at all had so many protected government witnesses out there that these guys were just yes-anding each other into carrying this shit out.
Whoa.
In fact, one ATF agent told a story about how the ATF and the FBI were supposed to get together to share information about Elohim City. And according to the agent, the two agencies met in a conference room, had small talk, and left without mentioning Elohim City once, all because each agency didn't trust the other one. And if there was a big bust to be had at Elohim City, that specific agency wanted the credit for it.
Like, thank you so much for having us over, FBI. Couldn't help but notice in this conference room you have so many squeaky chairs.
Nice to see you, CIA. Man, these chairs are squeaky.
Would be a shame if someone came in here and oiled some of these squeaky chairs.
These chairs could use some oil.
Because the squeaking I'm hearing is damn near unacceptable.
Man, this is a heck of a meeting.
Right?
It's
kind of fun.
Kind of fun.
Can you feel a weird, like, it's like tension.
Are you playing Genesis?
Yes. Yes, I got it from when I was a child. It's my Game Gear.
Now, this sort of interdepartmental rivalry was the exact same behavior that led to 9/11 just 6 years later, when the CIA and the FBI weren't talking to each other. Nothing was learned from Oklahoma City by these people, and thousands of people died because of it.
Do you ever think of the paperwork, though, Marcus?
Yeah.
Honestly, how much paperwork? So much they avoided. They saved the trees.
Mm-hmm. I love that the CIA and the FBI were like that comic strip, the Lockhorns, just never getting along. It's really funny in the strip, but then in reality, it leads to domestic terrorism.
Mm-hmm. Now, after the robbery was done, Nichols decided the heat was getting a little too high, so he fucked off to the Philippines with Mara Faye for a couple of months, even though Nichols was terrified that Mara Faye's ex-boyfriend, Jojo Angelito Florida, was going to come calling.
Hey, do you see how many baskets of ripe papayas I have? Marife, where is my sweet, sweet Marife?
I would have loved to see that fight.
Him just slapping him with sashes and throwing papayas at him.
No,
just fuck my wife. I'll let you fuck my wife,
please.
Now, when McVeigh realized that Nichols had left the country, he turned to Michael Fortier to help him out.
Michael, my best friend Michael. How do we never see each other?
No, not Jojo Angelito Florida. Timothy McVeigh turned to Michael Fortier. Uh-oh. Jesus Christ.
Jojo is my favorite name ever on this podcast, by the way.
Jojo Angelito Florida?
Yeah, it's just a lot of fun.
Now, McVeigh, once he hooked back up with Michael Fortier, he laid out the entire bombing play for the Fortier family, even going so far as to show Fortier's wife how he planned to position the barrels in the truck using 15 cans of soup as a visual aid.
Now, tell me, are these cans gonna actually be filled with soup?
No. Ammonium nitrate.
So you can't even say the name. How am I supposed to trust you? You're going to take this building down. I'm thinking we just use soup, and we slowly kill them with sodium.
The world's biggest soup bomb.
So in December of 1994, McVeigh and Fortier went to the Alfred P. Mura building to case the joint. McVeigh, despite his many protests to the opposite, was seen inside the Mura building that day. And not only that, McVeigh actually talked to one of the women who worked at the daycare specifically about the daycare center.
What
McVeigh,
a scumbag.
McVeigh said that he had two young kids and was planning to move into the area. He asked no questions about the daycare operations themselves and was only interested in the layout, where the entrances were, where the exits were, and he was very interested in the plate glass windows next to the infant's nap area.
If someone that looks like Timothy McVeigh says they have two young kids, go find them and return them to their parents.
Now, according to the woman he talked to, McVeigh kept repeating, "There's just so much glass," over and over and over again.
Can I just ask you, can I just see an infant? Because I just want to feel how soft it is.
It's a creepy question, Tim.
Is it?
Yes.
Well, I mean, I obviously have two kids of my own, so I know how soft they are.
What's the name of your children?
Ram Jam and Daycare Center.
But as this woman was talking to Timothy McVeigh, her fiancé showed up. So McVeigh hid behind a corner and ran away through the back door.
There's also a witness that put Strassmeyer there with him.
On that day.
On that day that Strassmeyer was around. And again, the way you can tell that that fucking Strassmeyer was there was that they said it was a buck-toothed man with a German accent. And it's very difficult to miss. I feel like if you are a fucking, you're an agent, you're trying to hide it from, trying to hide your identity from people, you wear a bandana.
Yeah.
Or you change your teeth. Or you at least pretend to have another accent. I do it all the time.
It just seems like a stupid Quentin Tarantino movie. So we had the German was there.
I mean, it's definitely closer to Bottle Rocket than Pulp Fiction.
Yes, that's true. So the German was there, Fortier was there, and McVeigh. All three of them.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, we don't know for sure if Strassmeyer was there, but we definitely know McVeigh and Fortier were there. Now, the only reason why this daycare center encounter wasn't introduced into trial was because that witness confused that incident with another incident with a weirdo that happened in March when the FBI knew McVeigh was in Arizona. But this visit coincided completely with Michael Fortier's testimony that they were in Oklahoma City in December of 1994. And this woman gave this statement prior to that being public knowledge. 1994 is also when a couple of characters named Dennis Mahon and Carol Howe walk onto the Elohim City, Oklahoma City stage.
Finally. This is their star moment.
It just gets dumber.
Now, Andreas Strassmeyer was friends with a white supremacist named Dennis Mahon, who was considered to be so dangerous by the UK and Canada that they barred him from entering their countries on the grounds that he was an international terrorist.
But honestly, he just did not like the Toronto Raptors.
I don't think they were around yet.
And Mahon is a former Imperial Dragon of the KKK and is also the leader of the White Aryan Resistance, a.k.a. War, in Tulsa.
Which is around still.
Yeah, definitely still around. He is also on camera saying that one day there will be a 100-foot-tall statue of Timothy McVeigh, celebrated patriot.
Wow, a 100-foot statue.
Wow. 100-foot.
Wow.
Now, John Millar, son of Robert Millar and the current patriarch of Elohim City, considers Dennis Mahon to be a friend.
Oh.
Good.
Now, let's hear a little from John Millar about his thoughts on people like Dennis Mahon and their beliefs.
I would say I don't realize why being a racialist makes you a hater. You have people today, they'll raise quarter horses, and they're very peculiar with each quarter horse and how they, you know, breed them in order to get a show horse, or with, you know, bulldogs or Pomeranians or any other animal like that. So in order to, you know, save the integrity of each species, it's important that they stay within their own group. And that's the way we feel and what we feel the scripture teaches like that.
Yeah, the scripture of Looney Tunes, the book of Elmer Fudd.
I don't want to malign people with interesting voices.
You can't absolutely malign his fucking ass. He's got a shitty voice. Sounds like an idiot.
I've never heard the term racialist before.
You never heard the term wasoist.
Oh, wasoist. What an idiot.
No, Millar went on to say this in an article about Elohim City about Dennis Mahon.
No, I don't know what he's done in his life. He seemed like a decent man to me. I agree with some of his thoughts. Not all of them, not by a long shot, but I do agree with some of his thoughts.
He sounds like someone who is just constantly getting his gums numbed by a dentist.
Oh, Mr. Ballard, what thoughts do you agree on?
We all like a milkshake, and we all agree that the wastes should be separated and ice cream should be separated. I hate to mix the ice cream when you put the chocolate and the vanilla together.
Oh,
it's just
man.
A shame. I hate to swoo.
It's one of the best combos there is.
And Mahan's girlfriend was a woman named Carol Howe. Those two met when Howe called Mahan's dial-a-racist hotline after she had what sounded like a minor confrontation with some black dudes at a party.
Dial-a-racist?
Dial-a-racist,
yeah. What was the number?
I'm not even going to say.
Please don't. Please don't.
No, it was a phone number that people could call to report incidents with races other than white people. Bad experiences.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So Carol Howe was a Tulsa debutante whose brand of rebellion was joining a white supremacist group and getting a big black swastika tattooed on her back. She started dating Mahan, but when she tried to leave, he raped her. She filed charges, which is when the FBI, looking for an informant to infiltrate right-wing extremist groups, recruited her.
It's the best way to get an informant. Ex-girlfriends.
Yeah.
Oh, sure.
Now, she reconnected with Mahan in late 1994 and started reporting back what she was seeing and hearing. Apparently, Mahan was spending his time detonating homemade hand grenades and was planning to blow up a Mexican-owned video store, but the ATF sat on it.
Look around there. It's got a Mexican name right on it. It's a video.
It's video. That's
no, video story. Some kind of Mexican talking, getting there. Damn Mexicans dancing with joy, celebration, drinking beers, having being relaxed. Celebrating, working hard, and selling, supporting their families. I hate them damn video stories.
What a jackass.
And when Mahan bragged about setting off a 500-pound ammonium nitrate bomb in Michigan, the ATF still did nothing. Now, Howe was just supposed to keep tabs on Mahan, but when she eventually made her way to Elohim City, she found Strassmeyer's boot camp and was told by the FBI to refocus on Strassmeyer, goofy or not.
Honestly, I saw a video of Dennis Mahan when he was going through. He was doing training at the CSA, and it showed him firing various guns. And then he had a Dillinger, and he was struggling to put it on top of his head and covering it with his hat. Like he was trying to show that he could have a gun under his hat, and he would put it on his hat and it was sliding back and forth, his hat going, and he kept trying to take off the hat and reveal the Derringer at the same time, and it looks like fucking a Chris Farley movie.
Yeah, it's brilliant.
Now, in December 1994, the same month that McVeigh and Fortier went to case the Mura building, Howe filed a report that Strassmeyer was planning to take action with assassinations, mass shootings, and bombings. That same month, Robert Millar instructed his troops in a fiery sermon to finally take action. Mm. Howe was also told that something was being planned for April, but she wasn't far enough into the inner circle to find out what exactly. In other words, the government had way more reason to raid Elohim City than they had to raid Waco. Mahan had hand grenades, large explosions using ammonium nitrate, and violent rhetoric, while Strassmeyer, who was an illegal alien and could have been arrested at any time, was arming and training a combat force.
And I heard he has guns under his hat.
You don't know what I got in my shoes.
Guns.
Feet. It's feet. My feet are just gross, feet. Though. They are gross.
Okay.
But because the ATF and the FBI were still reeling from the bad press of Waco, they recalled Carol Howe, declaring her an unreliable witness, and just hoped that everything was going to work itself out.
That's what I want out of my government agencies, hope.
But honestly, Carol Howe herself was very unreliable. I would say she was
contradictory, but a lot of her information was corroborated.
Because she kept going back and forth, fucking Mahan and not, because they got back together. The part of it, when she came back as an informant, she was like around the area and hanging out and watching everything, still in his vicinity, but he got her back. Mm-hmm. And so when they began to date again, she went off the radar. Mm-hmm. And then when they broke up again, she came back and started talking to the FBI.
Yeah, maybe not the most trustworthy person.
But she did have a fair amount of information. Her information about these people was being corroborated by shit they already knew about these people. And the ATF director at the time, John McGaw, said in 2010 that the only reason why they didn't go into Elohim City was because the ATF hadn't been properly retrained after Waco and they weren't ready for a proper full-scale assault. And McGaw also acknowledged in 2010 that the decision to not go into Elohim City might have cost the ATF their one slim chance to prevent Oklahoma City. City. But it must also be said that Howe never gave information about April 19th, 1995, specifically until the bombing had already happened.
But also, these groups learned from Waco as well. And they learned how to cover their tracks a little bit more. And I think that's a part of it, too. The guys that are really in charge, I always believe there's kind of a trickle-down of intelligence in these groups, where the guys that are in charge, like Millar, Ellison, they are actually very smart. As the ranks get lower and lower, people get dumber and dumber.
In the context of white supremacists.
Yes. And so what I think that they did is they understand is that what you do is you hire dummies that don't know what they're doing, that you can pawn off. Lots of patsies. You have many patsies everywhere. You also have no proof, no written proof, no paper trails. None of that. And so they did that. They did that very well. It would be very difficult for them to actually pull together the legal case to get the warrant to go into Elohim City. And then once they do it, how do you prosecute them if they hide all their fucking weapons?
There's an illegal German with guns under his hat.
Well, you got that guy. But that's the thing. You get that guy, and then you got that guy, and that's it.
Then you flip that guy.
No, he can't be flipped. Look at his teeth.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that argument right there, we're going to get into later on in the episode, because that is the exact same argument that the government used to not go after all these guys. Mm. And it is a shitty fucking argument.
Yes, of course.
So let me ask it.
Oh, questions.
Y'all ready to get sexy?
Oh, I don't know.
I was
in the context of Timothy McVeigh in Oklahoma City.
I woke up this morning.
Y'all ready to get sexy?
Am I ready to get sexy like now?
Sexy! I had a dream last night. Rose McGowan was my dream. And I was eating a bagel. Nude. This is true. I woke up. Ding, 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 hard.
Was it the bagel or Rose McGowan that got you aroused?
I don't know. I'm ready for the story.
Okay.
So in February of 1995, Timothy McVeigh was picked up as he was walking across a bridge near Bullhead, Arizona, by a man in a Ford Mustang.
This is getting spicy now. I don't want to think about what is about to happen.
And McVeigh offered the guy $5 to give him a ride to Kingman. The guy, named Richard Rogers,
Dickie Rogers,
he said he wouldn't take a dime. But he would be interested in a little fucking, as he had been at a casino all night and was feeling, quote, a little horny.
With something about you go to that slot machine and you pull that long pole and it's got the thick head on the top and then berries go whipping past your face.
This guy without a doubt had the ass gas or grass bumper sticker with a Calvin and Hobbes pissing on like a Ford logo or something.
Funny thing was, Rogers said he immediately recognized McVeigh from another roadside encounter he'd had the year before.
Aren't you the centerfold, the July centerfold of Brush Cut Monthly?
I'm flattered you remembered. Favorite things? Talking about Waco. Loading my gun. Sucking dick.
Now, the first time Rogers had picked up little Timothy McVeigh, Timothy took his dick out and asked Rogers if he wanted to party, which is slang for homosexual sex.
Thank you, Marcus.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. So that's what all these Facebook invites are about?
Interesting.
Rogers said no the first time, but yes the second. And the two ended up in Rogers' trailer outside Kingman.
When the trailers are rocking, do come a-knocking, because I am fighting a snake.
Now, the only thing that makes me think this story is true is that Rogers said as soon as they got into the trailer, McVeigh immediately just started talking about Waco.
Oh, no. That's a total boner killer.
He always does this. Not for when you're on the far right.
I guess not.
Fucking feeder.
I guess so.
But when they finally got down to business, Rogers said McVeigh's throat and tongue action was, quote,
incredible.
Ugh, throat and tongue action. God.
4 stars on Yelp. I would have given him 5 stars if he had made me Yelp. Again, Yelp is about yelling.
I understand. I never want to think about this ever again.
Actually, the thing was that Rogers said that neither one of them reached climax that night because they were just both too tired.
I don't understand. You would go so far as to pay another weird militant man to have sex with you, you're not going to come?
This was all free.
He
refused payment.
He refused payment.
He's not a plastic patriot.
You don't monetize love.
Now, in the morning, Rogers made McVeigh bacon and eggs. McVeigh left. And the two never had another experience aside from a couple of awkward run-ins at the grocery store.
Oh, hey. I'm sorry. I'm just trying to get around you to over here to the cucumbers. Hey, Tim?
You know, my cart's got a squeaky wheel.
Yeah. Yeah, me too. I guess I could really use some lubricant.
Man, a sale on pretzels?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, kind of like a bunch of legs all wrapped around each other in a trailer deep in the Ozarks.
Anyway. Reader's Digest.
Yeah, tell me about it.
Well, not too long after that, McVeigh forged a driver's license at the Fortier house using the alias Robert Kling so he could rent the Ryder truck he would eventually use for the bombing in Oklahoma City on April 19th. McVeigh chose Kling partly because he knew a soldier named Kling who kind of looked like him, but mostly because Kling was short for Klingon, because if you'll remember, McVeigh was a massive fucking nerd. Wow.
What is going on?
Because Klingon's a warrior.
Yeah,
I understand.
Worf.
He is such...
Worf was the true warrior. Casual homosexual Worf.
This is what we need: football players in every community that would just bully Timothy McVeigh.
No, on April 5th, McVeigh called Elohim City for just under 2 minutes, which we know for a fact because McVeigh used a calling card for all of his long-distance calls. We actually know quite a bit about the places that McVeigh called in the months leading up to the bombing.
Because he had a calling card.
Yeah.
He used one of those cards where you pay it, and then you can use it at various payphones, and that's how they basically ping him everywhere he goes. Hmm. We know that he was probably at Elohim City. We know the fact that the all of these concepts, the idea of bombing a federal building, especially in Oklahoma City, specifically the Murrah Building, have been floating around Elohim City. Mm-hmm. And he definitely had contact to Strassmeyer. They probably cased the Murrah Building together.
Do you think they kissed?
I don't know. I don't think Strassmeyer is type. He needs something more gruff.
I guess.
And when McVeigh called Elohim City, Millar's daughter-in-law was the one who answered, and she told the FBI that McVeigh was looking for Strassmeyer. McVeigh told her that he was thinking of visiting soon, and Millar's daughter-in-law said that any friend of Andy's was a friend of Elohim City.
Isn't that nice? Did I mention I'm African-American? Oh, never mind.
Oh, yikes!
Now, the reason why this call was significant was because it was made directly after McVeigh had called a rental spot in Havasu City near Kingman inquiring about a Ryder truck. It gets even more interesting when you take into account another call that was made from McVeigh to Elohim City right after McVeigh secured the Ryder truck rental in Junction City, Kansas. Now, it could be that McVeigh was calling Strassmeyer to update him on the progress of their mission, if Strassmeyer was indeed involved. Or it could be that McVeigh was just looking for a place to hide out after the bombing. However, McVeigh did once tell one of his defense lawyers that Elohim City was, quote,
pretty fucking hardcore.
And that cool. He and Strassmeyer were, quote,
brothers in arms. Cool. Literally in each other's arms.
So a few days after that second call, McVeigh was seen at a strip club in Tulsa called Lady Godiva's, which only has 3 stars on Yelp.
She died by fucking a horse.
Really?
No. Lady Godiva.
No, Lady Godiva rode a horse naked. And you're thinking of the Catherine, the great urban legend that she died fucking a horse.
These Marcus is very horses. Serious about this. I don't know. I don't know who to believe, quite
well,
frankly.
Fake news. That's believe me.
I don't know.
Believe me. Who's the one that does all the research here?
I heard Lady Godiva had intercourse with a horse.
See?
That then led to her inevitable death.
And
that's what I know.
Make truth happen.
Oh, other thing about Lady Godiva's, though, is that they have a daily lunch special, and on Fridays, you can get a BLT for just $5.
Wow. And who doesn't want a bacon, lettuce, and tomato sandwich from a strip club?
Tuesdays are quesadillas.
Wow.
And look, hey, see how I'm making here. I go over here. Name's Gunther. It's been so nice. So nice to see you around. You want a BLT?
I'm just here for that, yeah.
I could tell, you know why? Because your lips kind of look like little strips of bacon, and that makes my... Okay. Look over here. First, I gotta open up this loaf of bread using just my feet.
Okay, I just want the BLT.
Oh, yeah. Now I get this slice of bread. Then the funny thing about my little
body. I'm
going
to come back for quesadilla too.
No. You got to let me make this sandwich for you. Well. Look, let me show you why they call me the octopus downstairs. I take off my big old sailor panties, and you see how long my vagina is?
BLT's kind of a healthy alternative
Watch
to
this.
A hamburger.
Slap a tentacle on top of that pizza bread. Dragging over. Yeah, this is how I get my squats in.
I really.
And then you got fried and bacon. My other tentacle's getting all burned up by the oil split.
It's actually a really good sandwich, thank you.
You welcome to the street.
A stripper working that night specifically remembered McVeigh being there with an annoying buck-toothed German.
Oh.
Now I'm sure you're thinking, Ben. But it's
what? Don't address this to me.
I'm just saying that they seem to have a lot of times strippers have short-term memories.
Yeah, uh-huh. Yeah. It's odd that a stripper would remember one customer out of the no doubt dozens that they had over the month of April 1995.
Maybe if they're 6'7" and red-haired and just out there.
I don't know. They I think they want to forget most of the customers they see.
I think so. Yeah. But here's audio from the stripper's dressing room captured the night that Timothy McVeigh was there.
And I think we should say sex worker.
They're not sex
workers. They're not sex workers. They're dancers.
They're exotic
dancers. Strippers.
Yeah, they're strippers. They're not sex workers.
Yeah, they're not jerking off always.
If they were jerking dudes off in the back room, then we would say sex workers.
Oh, okay.
But right now, they're just exotic dancers.
Fancy.
They might be sex workers.
They're
though.
Strippers.
I don't know.
It's Lady Godiva's.
Oh, Lady Godiva. I heard she had intercourse with a horse.
It is a Tulsa, Oklahoma strip club.
Yeah, that's rough.
Yeah, over. You know what else is in Tulsa, Oklahoma?
What?
The Bottoms Up Club.
Mm. What happens there?
Bottoms up.
Bottoms up. That's where Polish people park their bikes. Because that's what they say when Polish people are die, they're bored with their asses sticking out of the grid.
Well, here is a clip. This is the audio from the video surveillance footage that was in the stripper's dressing room that night.
I'm a very smart man. I said, you are? And he goes, yeah. And you're going to remember me. On April 1995, you're going to remember me for the rest of your life.
Shit.
What did she say there?
She said, you're going to remember me, because McVeigh sat down. McVeigh was getting a lap dance, and he told her, I'm a really smart guy. And then he went further saying, on April 19th, 1995, you're going to remember me for the rest of your life.
Interesting.
Yeah. Honestly, our strippers are the front lines of American intelligence, because you can get so much information out of a man if you're dancing on his hard penis.
I guess I would. Yeah, absolutely.
Well, along with McVeigh and Strassmeyer was an olive-skinned, dark-complected man who bore a strong resemblance to John Doe number 2, uh-oh, who will now finally make his appearance. God, I've been waiting for 3 episodes to talk about John Doe number 2.
Comes from a long line of John Does. His father was John Doe number 1.
So on April 17th, 1995, Timothy McVeigh went to Junction City, Kansas, checked into the Dreamland Motel, and traveled over to Elliot's Body Shop, where he rented the Ryder truck he used in the bombing. Hmm. Now, as we said in episode 1, when the axle from the Ryder truck was found in downtown Oklahoma City after the bombing, it was traced to Elliot's Body Shop in Junction City, Kansas, and a sketch was done of McVeigh. But according to the witnesses who described McVeigh, he was not alone. A second sketch was done of a man, still known to this day, only as John Doe number 2. All 3 witnesses who saw McVeigh that day all agreed that McVeigh was not alone, and they all agreed on the basic physical characteristics of JD2, namely that he was short, stocky, and dark-skinned. Now, the sketch of John Doe number 2 that we know is actually all wrong. Nobody really knows quite how that sketch got to be the sketch of record, but the people who describe JD2 have said on multiple occasions that that's not the guy they saw. In fact, no one has ever really recognized the guy in that sketch. But when a second sketch of John Doe number 2 was done, more and more people started saying that they'd seen the man with the olive skin with McVeigh, particularly on the morning of the bombing itself. A property owner in Missouri said McVeigh, Nichols, and JD2 showed up a couple of months before the bombing inquiring about a property with a cave, possibly a place where McVeigh could hide out after the bombing.
Interesting. He wanted to be a cave dweller?
I guess so.
It's a good place to hide out. The property owner described McVeigh with uncanny detail, right down to a discolored eye tooth on the upper right side of his mouth and a filling McVeigh had showing through his enamel.
Why is he looking at his mouth
so
much?
That seems like way intense information to have.
And this guy, he actually did. Well, this was when the defense attorneys were going around, McVeigh's defense attorneys were going around trying to find out if there was anyone else involved in this. They found this guy, he had a photographic memory. He described the eye tooth. He described the filling. And then the defense attorney went back to McVeigh and got him to smile. And when McVeigh smiled, he saw that he had the discolored eye tooth and the enamel filling.
I guess it's true.
Did they just bring a bunch of construction workers into the courtroom and just be like, smile? Hey, why don't you smile a little bit?
Smile for me. Smile.
Can you imagine watching Timothy McVeigh forced to smile? How awkward that would be?
No, he told a funny joke and he made him laugh.
It is funny because when I do describe you, Marcus, I think about you. I mean, like, he looks like a haunted man with monkey arms and a big butt.
Well, that's nice.
You're not going to fucking bring in a mouthful of teeth like broken glass?
Only if you're smiling. But you don't normally smile.
Not doing this show, yes.
You can force a good smile.
I can force a very good smile. Yeah. Now, JD2 gave his name as Robert Jax, although that's proved to be an alias. However, the name Jax is found written in Mara Faye Nichols' address book in a number of different spellings.
She was learning the language.
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah. Now, the FBI's explanation of JD2 was that the eyewitnesses at the Ryder cider shop. All three confused the day on which they saw JD2. That JD2 was actually a guy named Todd Bunting who would come in the day after.
My grandfather changed name from Cunting.
Todd Bunting of the Bunting family.
But the eyewitnesses maintain that the man in the second sketch is the person who was with Timothy McVeigh on that day, and Todd Bunting was a guy they all actually knew.
My grandfather felt that the name Cunting would not allow his dentistry industry to really take off.
That makes Bunting is a much better name.
And interestingly, JD2 shares quite a few similarities with Richard Guthrie, the ARA bank robber we discussed last episode.
Now, is Richard Guthrie possibly another U.S. government plant, however, trying to force the bombing to happen from the inside? I'm not saying it's always sheep-dipped.
It's never sheep-dipped. They don't do that.
No, it wouldn't.
No,
really,
there
wouldn't
be. There any, is. There is.
I don't think the FBI would really want that to happen.
In the Vietnam War, there was several members. Basically, they continued the Vietnam War for about a year with like a bunch of CIA operatives that were fighting with no identities, fighting in Vietnam for a long time.
That's kind of fun. I do think when you mention those things, which that actually might be accurate, you should have a McDonald's cup, and I will put change in it.
So on April 16th, the day before the rental, Lee McGowan, the owner of the Dreamland Motel where McVeigh stayed in Junction City, said she heard voices coming from McVeigh's room. She also maintained that these men had access to the room independent of McVeigh, who was dropping off the getaway car in downtown Oklahoma City when McGowan heard them speaking. McGowan remembered she heard, in her words, a velvety male voice that she recognized from an earlier phone call to room 25 where McVeigh was staying.
It sounded like he would have really good throat and tonsil action.
Yes.
Just one of those voices.
And she wasn't the only one. On April 15th, a Chinese food delivery boy named Jeff Davis.
Very good. Very good name.
Authentic.
Now, son, with this name, no one will know that you're Chinese.
Jeff Davis said he brought food to the room and someone other than McVeigh answered the door. That man was short, stocky, dark complected.
And loved dumplings.
Actually, it was Mugu Gai Pan.
Ooh, that is good. I like that.
I like Mugu. It's a little slimy, though.
That's fine. Yeah.
Definitely a deep cut on the menu. That's how I can tell.
I've never seen you be disgusted by food before, so that's interesting.
So on April 18th, the day before the bombing, McVeigh said he met up with Terry Nichols at the storage locker they shared. The two loaded up all the bomb-making materials they gathered, and they drove it all out to Geary Lake State Park in Kansas. There, they allegedly mixed the material and wired up the whole operation in just a day, supposedly all by themselves. And after they were done, McVeigh said Nichols headed home while McVeigh slept with the bomb for the night.
Did he, like, cuddle it?
He slept in the cab and the bomb was in the back. And then he said when he got up the next morning, he ate a whole bunch of spaghetti and then went to Oklahoma City.
Oh, everybody who goes to Oklahoma City has got a belly full of spaghetti.
That's right.
Well, he liked to eat MREs, meals ready to eat.
I am sick of these militiamen. They all live like shit. They think that this is the way to go. You have to, like, live some weird soldier's life where it's just like, just go in your home. Go to get a burger. Get Burger King.
Yeah, just make a peanut butter and jelly sandwich. Put it in a bag, bring it with you.
Spaghetti's kind of good, though.
Yeah. But the stories witnesses in Oklahoma City on April 19th told about what happened that day suggest a very different story besides just McVeigh and Nichols being involved in this. The first sighting of the Ryder truck on April 19th was at around 8 a.m. At least 24 people saw the truck over the next hour, with many of them reporting it was in a convoy with a yellow Mercury Marquis, a brown truck, and a white sedan. Three witnesses said a man with a military cut, accompanied by a man with olive skin, driving a yellow Ryder truck, asked them for directions to the Mura building that morning. Danny Wilkerson, the guy who ran the convenience store down the street from the Mura building, said McVeigh came in around 8:40 a.m. and bought two Cokes and a pack of Marlboros, even though McVeigh was not a smoker. And Wilkerson remembered this encounter because of the Ryder truck parked outside.
Maybe he did that because of Bad Boys, the film Bad Boys, where he saw them lighting a cigarette walking away from the explosion. They, you know, make him look real cool.
Or did he buy it for John Doe number two?
That's what we're saying.
Yeah, that's what we're saying.
That is
actually...
I also thought it could be because of Bad Boys.
Oh.
Godiva.
She had get fucked by a horse.
Isn't that weird?
No, Wilkerson asked McVeigh when he saw the Ryder truck if McVeigh was moving in, and McVeigh said he wasn't. And when McVeigh walked out to the truck, Wilkerson said he saw another guy waiting in the cab. None of the eyewitnesses, nor the other 19 people who saw McVeigh either with a group or with at least another guy that morning, were called to trial because the FBI determined that every single one of them was mistaken.
Now, remember, we have been through this before with Columbine, when people saw multiple shooters that were not just the two boys. This is a thing that does happen. There is such a thing as like imagining and piecing together different witness accounts, and it all brings together. But the problem is that what you're looking at is over several days, showing that he is with multiple people, whether he's renting the truck, whether he is putting together the bomb. I feel like that there is a bunch of loose evidence that can show that he at least had a group supporting him, and at least had like a team around him that were going to try to get him to the getaway car, that they weren't going to. He was going to basically set off the explosive himself.
Well, that seems very plausible. It's a huge bomb. And no way he and Nichols could just do it alone.
Well, I mean, there is actually evidence. There was a guy who saw the Yellow Rider truck at Geary Lake on that day.
Yes, so we
saw
the two of them together, him and Nichols up together. They were basically building the bomb.
Yeah. Yeah, they were building the bomb up there, but we don't know if anybody gave them instructions or if Nichols and McVeigh were just putting the finishing touches on the bomb. There's a lot of unknowns here. And it could be that all these witnesses, they heard reports of John Doe number 2, and they concocted a story in their head about seeing McVeigh with a dark-skinned gentleman that.
Perhaps.
Way. But the convoy of the brown truck, white sedan, and yellow marquee, that wasn't reported at the time. And multiple people told the FBI that they saw him together. And multiple people saw this convoy struggling to get to their destination.
Also, it was his yellow marquee, right? That was his car. Mm-hmm. We know that for a fact.
We know the yellow marquee was his car.
If he is driving the Ryder truck, who is driving that car?
Exactly.
Somebody's driving the car. Yeah. And it's a big, obvious, gross, like, grossly yellow, all fucked up.
A 1978 Mercury Marquis is a gigantic fucking car.
Yeah, it sticks out, so somebody's helping him.
Who's behind the wheel?
Yeah. And the people that saw them trying to struggle to their destination, they saw those cars driving in and out of the underground parking garage below the Mura building.
Because this is when he realized that he did not measure the goddamn parking garage Zamora entrance, and he couldn't get it through.
Yeah, he couldn't get it. The Ryder truck was too tall. He tried driving it in there. They had this whole big plan, and then they realized that the truck was just too high. They had neglected to do their due diligence on possibly the most important part of the entire operation.
Somebody unbelievable. One job.
Now, the backup plan, maybe, was to park the truck in the alley between the federal courthouse and the old post office building. We know this because an Oklahoma State trooper saw the truck pull into the alley and back out again when they saw it was blocked by a U.S. Marshals Service truck. Hmm. As Andrew Gumbel wrote in Oklahoma City what the investigation missed, one can only imagine these dipshits frantically trying to decide what the hell to do when their great master plan failed.
It is just a bunch of dunces trying to pull this off.
Yeah, but of course we all know what they ended up doing. You know, they parked it in the handicapped spot on the building's north side. But witnesses saw both the marquee and the brown truck on either side of the Ryder truck. They also witnessed a woman with long blonde hair waving the truck into position, who very well could have been ARA bank robber Pete Langan in drag.
Imagine if he showed up in full costume, like he was like dressed as a woman, being a woman, and they never saw that before. And all of a sudden, he just shows up on the big day.
Pete, what you doing?
I'm finally me.
On today of all days.
Fuck it, go. We ain't got time to deal with this. Fuck it.
Now, the main witness, who was watching from the fourth floor of a nearby building, made note of the 1979 Mercury Marquis because that guy had a Mercury Marquis just like it.
Oh.
And so he actually, it wasn't one of those things where he remembered later, like, oh, there was a Mercury Marquis there. He remembered looking down, seeing a yellow Mercury Marquis, thinking about days of yore.
Probably like, what a piece of shit car that is.
Yeah. I'm glad I don't own a fucking Mercury Marquis anymore. But he also noticed like there was a Ryder truck parked in the handicap spot because that's a pretty big dick move.
Right.
Then there was Dana Bradley, the woman who had to have her leg sawed off at the knee after being trapped in the rubble. She said when she was walking into the building, she saw a guy with olive skin wearing a jacket get out of the truck and quickly walk away. And yet another person, a truck driver named Rodney Johnson, had to
I love it. That's a great name for a truck driver. Great name.
He had to swerve to miss two people who had walked out into the road from his right. One, he identified as McVeigh. The other he identified as a stocky man with olive skin wearing a jacket. He said to his left was a brown truck, to his right was the Ryder truck. Again, none of this stuff was made public. These people were not contaminated by media coverage. These sightings were all done independently, and none of them, aside from Dana Bradley's, were made public until just a few years ago when new documents were finally released. A lot of these, this didn't actually come from news reports. These came from FBI files that were finally released in 2010.
Now, what is the point of not releasing this information to the public earlier? Is it just to make it a simple case?
Yes. The whole point is
open
to
it
just
close it.
Get Timothy McVeigh.
Right.
Kill him by the death penalty so the case is over. So there's closure. And then also, technically, you are not feeding the far right. Yeah. I think there's a part of it, too, where it's if they made it a big attack on the far right, they thought that they were going to incite more and more of this, which in the end is wrong. In the end, they bolstered them. And they technically
that's a tricky thing, though.
It did take a lot of wind out of their sails, especially when it came out just how many kids that were murdered in the explosion.
Yeah, of course.
And it did fuck up, but technically it just made them go deeper underground. And now they're there, and now they're electing people.
They regrouped. They absolutely regrouped.
They went legit.
Yeah. So after lighting the fuse, the group got into their respective getaway cars and sped away. But there's the question of the marquee. If there was such a large group, why was McVeigh alone in a car that had no license plate and was sure to get pulled over? Well, there are a couple of possible explanations here. One, McVeigh might not have meant to drive the car for very long. If he was working with Langan and Guthrie, he would have been playing by bank robber rules. See, a lot of times when a bank robbery is committed, the perpetrators use a drop car, meaning they leave in one car, drive it to a second location where their real getaway car is parked, and they leave the drop car behind. The Marquis could have been just such a car.
Also, he was probably making his money robbing banks for a period of time with the ARA. Mm-hmm. So that's exactly the type of training that he's already got.
Mm-hmm. Or, two, McVeigh meant to be caught. He was the sacrificial lamb, the one who would spread their message to the world, the spokesman. And when you compare McVeigh to the rest of these assholes, he was the obvious choice.
He's a perfect patsy. Yeah.
He was a clean-cut war hero. He was fairly well-spoken, and he had no criminal record whatsoever aside from a few traffic tickets.
So he'd look like a good American soldier, like the head of the Patriot movement.
Yep, and if anyone out of that group of dickheads could sound even halfway reasonable, it would have been McVeigh. All the rest of them, what are you going to put Strassmeyer out front?
No, with his buck teeth.
Yeah, put Goose Strassmeyer out there.
No, he's not camera ready. Nah, Timothy McVeigh is camera ready. Terry Nichols has got all the fucking best. He looks like, Terry Nichols looks like the main nerd from Revenge of the Nerds.
It's possible.
No, Terry Nichols has those little beady eyes. He's constantly nervous. You can't put Langan or Guthrie out there. They're fucking bank robbers. Yeah, Dennis Mahan is a big fat nightmare.
Right.
Fucking the Millar guy. He talks like Elmer Fudd.
Yeah.
McVeigh's the only one they have.
He's the Jim Parsons.
I guess so. Yeah, in this bizarre world of local yokels, he is the dreamboat, I suppose.
In terms of articulate, he's been coached.
Yeah.
He knows exactly what to say. He's been listening to these fucking idiots for so long. You don't think Millar and Ellison weren't piping literally the exact words, what to say as soon as you're caught, the things, the literature he had? Mm-hmm. And then he was obsessed with Patrick Henry already. And then when you found on his dashboard, he had an envelope of documents that were filled with, you know, Patrick Henry, various different far-right writers, all like he had his weird like thesis statement ready to go.
And the thesis statement, that's also a part of the drop car theory, is that a lot of people thought that McVeigh was going to drive the car, leave it, and then leave that little envelope of articles and whatnot for police to find, essentially taunting them.
Yes. Hmm.
But also the thing is about McVeigh is that McVeigh wanted this. You can tell in every interview he gave that he loved every second of his notoriety. When everyone saw him for the first time during that first perp walk, you do not see the face of a person scared shitless like Nichols was when he was arrested. You see the face of a stoic soldier who had done his duty.
Which shows like the unflappable and scary arm of the CSA, like the idea of someone being like, we are here to start the revolution.
Mm-hmm. And with, you know, if he ran out of things to say, he could always charm people with his Star Trek knowledge and with all of the different sort of things.
His dick sucking skills.
Yeah, he can talk about that.
Incredible.
I say incredible. Great throat and tongue action.
Now, there is definitely marquee-related evidence to suggest McVeigh acted alone, though. There's the note that suggests the car was dropped days earlier, and the license plate that was missing was stashed in the storage locker where McVeigh and Nichols stored the explosives. But that's the big rub with this case.
The big rub with Timothy McVeigh and that guy.
Yeah, that dude,
Richard Rodgers.
Yeah. Richard Rodgers, the big rub.
See, so much of this evidence can be interpreted either way. You can either interpret it as McVeigh being an idiot, or you can interpret it as McVeigh setting himself up to be the lone wolf. Now, we would know for sure if there were more people involved in the bombing, and especially if more people were in the truck with McVeigh, had the security cameras on the northwest and northeast corners of the Mira building been working. Ugh. But as a cost-cutting measure, the cameras were hooked to nothing and hadn't been functional for 10 years.
Which How much money did they save? How much money did that
save? They said 18 grand in the end was all the fixes they didn't make
no,
in the
18,
building?
No, 18 grand was the construction cost. This was probably, I don't know, 40 bucks.
Oh, my God.
But they... Also, this is again where the conspiracy arm takes a hold when people say that the government did that on purpose.
No,
because the government was trying to save money because they're a bunch of idiots.
Yeah, and that's what, no, that's when you talk to the guy who was in charge of security and said that he had been screaming for years to get the cameras fixed.
A nerd. He's being annoying. You got to learn how to sell it.
Well, that's the thing is that, you know, there were, of course, rumors of the footage being suppressed because there was a report that the Secret Service had made saying, like, okay, like, we have found the footage from the Mira building, but that was done in error. They thought that they had footage of the Mira building.
And they do not.
Because this is such a huge, fast-paced operation. There were hundreds of people working on this case all at once. But the thing is, like, as Gumbel writes, you know, in Oklahoma City, the incompetence here is a far greater crime. Than the cover-up. Because there was chatter among these right-wing groups for months leading up to it. They knew something was
coming. There's also been the dialogue on the internet that show that obviously takes certain footage that has been found from around the Mira building in order to say, like, look, you could see here, like, basically pointing out that there were multiple people in the cab. The problem is there's no time signatures. There's no way to know. And also, I watched two different documentaries, Terror from Within, which is fucking incredible, which we basically build this entire timeline of the white power groups helping Timothy McVeigh set up the Oklahoma City bombing, and then there's another one called The Secret Life of Timothy McVeigh, which is the complete conspiracy one, and they both use the same footage to say different things, one proving that he's a lone warrior and one proving that he's a part of the U.S. government as a sheep-dipped officer.
Do they get into how he earned the nickname The Rub? Means Tim The Rub McVeigh.
Wide palms.
Ugh.
Well, at any rate, the FBI either ignored or half-heartedly explained away most of the evidence we've talked about today. See, they didn't want to uncover a conspiracy. They wanted a straightforward, no-nonsense conviction, and they got two, as Nichols turned himself in after just a couple of days, because Timothy McVeigh had written down in the Dreamland Motel register as his address, he wrote the address of the Nichols family farm. Jesus
Very nice. Very nice.
Just couldn't think of another address.
Different kind of numbers that aren't real. Oh, man.
I can't be making up addresses all day.
Well, the 1988 sedition trial we mentioned in the last episode also had a lot to do with this. See, the FBI had decided that if they ever had another case against white supremacists, they would go for the slam dunk and not involve too many people. They were afraid if they went for all, they would get none, just as they had before. And there was, and this was against every instinct of every FBI agent to focus on just one guy. There were plenty of FBI agents out there crying to be let loose.
Because they are very thorough. The one thing about the FBI is that they are very dogged.
They go after Bureau of Investigation.
Yes.
That's what they do, investigate.
But the higher-ups wouldn't go for it, even though there were so many guys saying, please, please, this guy Bob Ricks. Like, Bob Ricks had spent most of his career chasing white supremacists, but for some reason the higher ups just wouldn't let him loose. See, it's almost unheard of for the FBI to ignore evidence that could lead him to bigger fish, but that could have led him to another Waco.
Or
Ruby Ridge, or another failed sedition trial.
And it's more egg on their face, and then the more weird bad PR they get, the harder it is for them to do other things within the government, because again, the government has to make political decisions, and so if you don't have the political movement on your side, there's not many things that you can get done.
Right. And the FBI tried its hardest to convince all the witnesses who said they saw McVeigh with another man to change their story. Some did and were put on the witness stand. Others didn't and weren't. Now again, there is no direct evidence that McVeigh was ever in Elohim City at any point, but it has been strongly suggested by a number of people, both in the far right and in law enforcement, that he was.
Because you remember, he also called CAUSE, which is essentially the White Power ACLU. It is a group of lawyers. Someone called in asking what to do about this bombing, whether or not they should bomb this building or not. I feel like that was another clue. There's another a sidebar of this whole world where it's like he was also trying to get their legal team involved.
It's a small world. this white supremacist world.
They have their own little weird ecosystem going.
Right.
Yeah, because they learn it from the Turner Diaries, because it sets it up within the Turner Diaries of how militia should communicate to each other.
But neither the far right nor law enforcement has admitted that McVeigh had help in this whole thing for one reason. None of them want blood on their hands, specifically the blood of 19 children. Now, after McVeigh was arrested and tried, the jury deliberated for 3.5 days before convicting McVeigh on all counts. In trying to save McVeigh's life, the best anyone could say about him came from Michael Fortier. He said,
"Honestly, if you don't consider what happened in Oklahoma, Tim is a good person."
Yeah, but we're mostly here for that Oklahoma City bombing thing.
Yeah, then he is a naughty, naughty, he's naughty boy.
The best thing I could say is, great throat action.
And after that statement, it took the jury about 3 hours to condemn McVeigh to death.
Still seems long to me, quite frankly.
It does.
It's just like, do it right
Can
there.
Can we just do it here?
Yeah, yeah. So maybe it was good food they were eating. I don't know.
So on June 11th, 2001, Timothy McVeigh was put to death by a lethal injection. Michael Fortier was sentenced to 12 years for his part in the saga, and Terry Nichols received a sentence of life in prison at the Colorado Supermax facility, where he remains to this day. Hmm. Richard Guthrie hung himself in prison. Pete Langan is doing life after a dramatic shootout with the police. Dennis Mahon is still giving dumb shit interviews. Elohim City still plugging along.
It is around, and they are fucking getting dumber.
And Andy the German is back in Germany.
Aww.
Having been smuggled out of America through Mexico after the FBI started asking questions about him. He said he moved back because Oklahoma had become, quote,
stressful.
That would make sense.
That's why a lot of people leave. A lot of Germans leave because of the stress.
I've always heard that about Oklahoma City, the stress level.
Yeah, Oklahoma, Elohim City, real stressful place.
Oh, yeah.
Now, so far, not a single other arrest besides Nichols, Fortier, and McVeigh has been made regarding the events of April 19th, 1995, and it's starting to look like there never will be.
I gotta say, Michael Fortier, that 12 years is light. That is a light sentence because they do know he's complicit in the mass tragedy. I feel like that's a little bit too light of a sentence.
Well, he turned state's evidence.
Michael
Fortier was the star witness against Timothy McVeigh.
So what do you mean, I'm like the star witness?
Yeah. He was the Lucille Ball of the witnesses. Wow. So I think we've all learned a lot today.
That is fascinating stuff. There's no way that Timothy McVeigh acted alone. Mm-hmm. And it's all that community. No. That was again, great. So the onion. Peeling back the onion.
Hey, guys, so this, just remind you out there, it's like, if you feel like really proud about something, like, dial it back before you murder a bunch of people.
Dial it back. But this is where rhetoric, when it actually turns to violence, it's very difficult for the FBI and the CIA to know when that's actually going to happen.
Yeah.
It's tricky stuff. It is too bad that they were licking their wounds from Waco and Ruby Ridge. You wonder if they would have just had a little bit more political incentive to actually stop this stuff.
But also, ideas can't be illegal. We cannot start shutting down one idea because then how do you do thought crime?
This went far beyond ideas.
Of course.
They had homemade grenades. They had ammonium nitrate. I am not arguing this.
I understand.
Of course, we are not advocating for the legislation against ideas or anything like that. But in this case, the ATF, they didn't go in for one simple reason. It was cowardice. That's what it is. That was the reason why they did not go in, because they were afraid that Waco was going to happen again. They were afraid that they were not good enough. And this is big boy shit. It's supposed to be hard.
They're not wrong to some degree. It would have been, who knows how it would have gone.
It would have been very difficult. It would have blown up.
Can you imagine if we might just do an episode on Elohim City, or however the hell you're pronouncing it. Elohim City, had they gone in there and had a huge firefight, what reality would that have created?
A bunch of people would have died. A bunch of people would have died on both sides. It would have been a big fucking gigantic clusterfuck, and it was very difficult to figure out how do you pull yourself out. Once you push the button, now the machine's going. Once you're in there, now you're going to deal with the reverberations, and then what if they decide to still blow up gigantic federal buildings after the raid?
I mean, after you raid Elohim City, after that, you get Bull Shoals Lake, Arkansas. I mean, that's what their fucking job is. They can't just say, they can't just sit back and hope everything's going to work out all right.
Well, that's
because
true.
They also tried that 6 years later in the lead up to 9/11, like with Osama bin Laden, when Susan Rice told Bill Clinton to not go
she
after
him. Yeah.
They pulled back and they hoped that everything was going to work out okay, and it fucking didn't because it never.
You know
ever
what?
I
am just you know what they should have gotten though? If we could have just sent them Stephen Urkel, Jaleel White,
he would have done
and
great.
And he just could have charmed
a bridge. I agree.
He's a bridge.
He is a bridge.
He's a bridge.
All right. Well, great episodes. Thank you so much for listening. Let's see. Anything we want to plug here, Marcus?
We are coming to Milwaukee this week. We're going to be in Nashville next week. We're going to be in Montreal the week after that. That's the Just for Last Festival. Go get your tickets for that. Last podcast. And then we're coming to North Carolina. We're coming to Omaha. We're coming to Pittsburgh. We're coming to Toronto. We can finally announce that we're going to be a part of the San Francisco Outside Bounds Festival, which is going to be
awesome.
Super
Queens
fucking
Queens of
cool.
the Stone Age, man.
Yeah, dude. Fucking
it's
Queens.
Metallica is playing too.
Metallica.
Right?
Oh,
that's so awesome.
Gorillaz. That's going to be cool as shit.
I'm
going to
meet Lars.
I want to meet
Octagon. Dr. Octagon.
Oh, I love Dr. Octagon.
Oh, it's going to be so fucking cool. I seriously doubt they're going to let us in with the musicians.
No, definitely they won't. No, we will be recorded off and netted into the podcast tent.
Do you remember during the SLC Comic Con about how far we were kept from Jason Momoa?
We were not allowed within, I don't know, 40 feet of him.
Yes.
But I stared at him long enough where I felt like I talked to him.
Yeah, and if you guys want any and all ticket information for that, just go to lastpodcastontheleft.com and all of that stuff is there.
That's it. Our Just for Laugh show is at 3 p.m., which is prime for
us.
We
got Thursday and Friday. So if you
come
can't
out
make
to that.
3 p.m. on Thursday, then you can make 3 p.m. on fucking
and
Friday.
And don't forget, it is Just for Laughs. So if you even think about not laughing, remember what you're just there for.
The Montreal Secret Police will just take you to get poutine. That is a punishment there. It is a punishment. So make sure you follow us on Twitter at Henry Loves You, at Marcus Parks, at Ben Kissel. Follow us on Instagram at Dr. Fantasty, at Marcus Parks, at Ben Kissel, the number one. Ooh. And follow Last Podcast on the Left on all of it at LP on the Left.
Yes, and thanks for all of our Patreon subscribers. You have all made this possible, and we really appreciate you.
Yeah, and if you guys want to give to our Patreon, go to patreon.com/lastpodcastontheleft. Sorry, we can't do it again. We're still in Los Angeles.
Yep.
We did two episodes in 2 days. Two gigantic episodes in 2 days. We still don't have our printouts from Travis over in New York City, but we'll get back to the shout-outs next week.
I promise you I will butcher your name next week. Don't worry about it. It's there.
Don't you worry about it. Hail Satan.
Hail yourselves.
Hail Gene.
Hail me.
Let's do a Magustalations.
Thank you.
Yeah, Magustalations.
The mouth action that you just used to say Magustalations was incredible.
God.